Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody, and happy 4th of July. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. On this week's episode, I've got Mr. Joe Sanek. Joe is a speaker, mental health counselor, business consultant, and podcaster. He has the number one podcast for counselors called the Practice of the Practice podcast. And he's interviewed the likes of Pat Flynn, John Lee Dumas, and Chris Ducker. But more importantly, Joe is just one hell of a guy who I find incredibly nice, easy to talk to, and super fun. I also want to note that starting now in July, both episodes every week are new. How about them apples, huh? So I'm pretty excited about that. I've had some great interviews over the last month or so, and things are just building towards the book. Three chapters down, four to go. It's not really true. Three to go. Intro, conclusion don't really count so much. So loving it. Please check it out on my website. Have a look. But I also want to turn down the music a little bit here. Can we turn down this music a little bit? Because, you know, as the 4th of July, it is now, you know, it's America's birthday. It's what we celebrate. We celebrate, you know, the founding, the beginning, all of that. And I think it's really important that we take a moment and think about the current political environment. And I don't talk politics very often. And that's fine, right? I don't want to shake a boat up, rock a boat. But man, is it just shockingly how shit it is right now. You know, not living in the country, you get a totally different perspective of what is being said, how it's being said, who is saying it, who is responding to it. And it's sad. It's just sad. You know, I was reading an article in the Huffington Post right before I recorded this. And it was the article about Mitch McConnell and his desire for power, his Machiavellianism, if you will. And what I found interesting, not so much that it was lambasting Mitch, but more, like we're a first name basis, but it was more importantly that it was about winning. And I think that we perhaps are losing sight of what's most important, because when we boil everything down to winning and losing, I feel like we're missing out on helping. And if that's what we are sending representatives to Washington for, is to help, it seems like we need to get off the camp of win and lose and what is best for the largest amount of society. Not everyone's always going to be happy. I'm not in some, you know, utopia world, but for God's sakes, man, when you boil everything down to winning and losing, I'm a competitive person. I played competitive sports. I'm competitive. But that's not what government is about. Government is not about winning. It's not about losing. It's about progress. It's about helping. It's about supporting. And it's about creating structures that will allow the citizens to move their life forward, to become better human beings, to have a better life, and hopefully have a better life than their family before them. And I read this rhetoric every day, and it depresses me that it's boiled down to a W and L. This is not the NBA, NHL, NFL, right? This is our lives. So I hope that we are able to, as a society, get through this phase and start thinking about others, not parties. Start thinking about what is needed, not what is wanted. And just Lord help us. That's all I got to say. So anyhow, to that ado, have a fantastic 4th of July weekend. Stay safe. Have fun. And that's right. This week is Joe Sanek. Amazing guest. Please like, subscribe on iTunes. leave a review. Check out my website, drjameskelly.com, K-E-L-L-E-Y. You can see what's going on with the book. I am past halfway. So excited to have a publisher I'm working with. That is going to be awesome. So you'll hear more and more of that as it goes on. All right, I'm done. See you. But I just, I saw how you, what you do, and it's obviously not the same premise from that perspective, but I love the fact that you're a psychologist who has found a gap in the market and created this business out of nowhere. So kind of like, where did this idea come from?
Yeah. So are we live now or you're just asking before?
We're just going.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. So the idea for me really was I had this private practice that was growing and I was reading all these business books and I just realized that nobody was talking about what I was learning. And so I just started from a co-learner standpoint and said, I'm going to just blog about what I'm learning and just kind of approach it as we don't learn this stuff in grad school. And so from there, that kind of blogging about what I was learning grew into, well, I should have a podcast where I can expand on these thoughts. And then
because more and more everybody people, needs a podcast nowadays.
And really at the time, the only other podcast for counselors in private practice was the American Counseling Association. And they hadn't posted in, man, like 6 or 8 months. So right away, I'm the number one podcast for counselors in private practice. And even if I get outranked, you know, I'll be the oldest podcast in for private practice. So either way, it was a win. And so really, I over time, I started to see that this side gig that really was, starting out with me learning about business and me just expanding on that, started bringing in more money than my full-time job at a community college. And my wife and I started talking about, you know, I'm working 10 hours a week doing this one thing and I'm working 40 hours a week. And, you know, the money on the 10 hours a week is just growing so much more than anything at the community college that we started talking about when it was time for me to exit from that full-time job.
So what was the biggest learning you got as you were doing this? Like if you were to pinpoint one thing that was kind of like this aha moment for you from a business book perspective.
Yeah, I think it was really just like do something, like get something done. Don't be paralyzed by perfection. Mm-hmm. Just do the work. And so often I think, especially for those of us that have higher education and masters and doctorates, we're so used to writing some 20-page thesis, revising it for 2 years and then finally turning it in and getting the approval or, you know, you got to come back in, you know, 3 months to meet with your committee again. It's so abnormal for us to think about writing a blog post and just putting it out there in a day. Mm-hmm. Let alone in a half hour. That for me, that switch of saying, I have something to say, it may not be perfect. I may spell something wrong, but I can go back and edit it. I'm not going to put anything out there that's going to ruin my career. It's going to just be small, minor adjustments. So when I realized if I just move quickly and I just get as much content out there as possible when I was starting out, that gave me such a competitive edge to other people.
Well, and it's cathartic, right? So as someone who has a PhD, there was nothing worse than writing a effing dissertation to have 5 people in total my whole entire life read that document that you pour your blood, sweat, tears, and Lord, I thought my firstborn child all at the same time. You know, and so when I started doing, I don't blog that often because my time is pretty fractured. I need to do a better job of it, but I've been writing a series of articles over the last few months and there's just something cathartic about it. It's, you know, it's freeing. It's like, so you get this as an academic, having done a thesis, and we'll kind of back up a little bit in a second, but there's something about not having to cite every effing thing that you write.
Right.
That is like freeing. And I don't think people who blog that aren't in academia can understand that perspective, but you can't write a paragraph without almost always having to cite something or someone to support what you've done. So for me, it was cathartic. I can imagine it was the same for you.
Absolutely. And to be able to, on the drive to work, say, I have this idea about how to write a blog post about, say, counseling websites, and these people that I respect, I'm going to kind of give some links to them. I'm going to do a video walkthrough. And then by noon, to have a video training done, a, you know, 1500 word article written, and have it be live, helping people and helping me with some passive income, because of course there's affiliate links within there. Like, it just felt like how it should be, that we can have ideas, we can create things, we can make time for it, and then we're going to in some way monetize that to fuel that creativity even more, was a total game changer for the way that I approached business.
That's awesome. So now you're in Travis City, Michigan, right?
Yeah. Northern Michigan, right on the water up here.
I feel like I've been there, but maybe just only in a dream at one point. I can't pinpoint it in my head. So are you from there?
Yeah. So my wife and I were both raised here. We met snowboarding in high school and then went our separate ways and went off to college. And but Michigan's home. Both of our families are here. It's right on the water. We love it. It's this cool little tourist town where Mario Batali summers and Michael Moore hangs out, and he started a film festival here. So it's this cool small town that really has all the culture of most big cities. So for us, it's perfect.
I can imagine Michael Moore's film festival is very art left.
Yes. I mean, like people like Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine and Susan Sarandon, they frequent the film festival here. Yeah. So, but I mean, they do a really good job of just bringing in thought-provoking films.
That's awesome. So now, I don't know how many interviews you've done on your podcast, The Practice of the Practice, but I've done just over 110 at this point. And without fail, probably 90% of the time, the people I interview that are from the Midwest have the most boring, healthy upbringing out of anyone I've met. So I don't want to stereotype that, but I'm going to ask the question. Like, did you grow up in a big family, small family? My assumption is always Catholic, but I don't know if that's true.
You must have done your research. Yes, my dad's Catholic, went to a Catholic school, K-12. But, you know, it was interesting, though. My mom, she's Protestant, and that was actually a huge deal when they got married in the 70s, that this Polish Catholic family, and my mom, she had been abused in her first marriage and then left. And the family was like, I can't believe you're marrying someone that's divorced. And it's like, wait, no, she left a domestic violence situation.
And isn't that funny how a Catholic looks at that part of it, not like the reason why?
Right. I know. Seriously.
How messed up is
and
that?
So
sorry.
For my family, it was great. They were progressive in a number of areas and traditional in a number of other areas. And, I would say it's a pretty healthy upbringing. You know, we had a field in the back of our house so that we could go play out in the woods, and was in the Boy Scouts. But, you know, we all have our issues that we get out of childhood, too.
So I always find it fascinating when people who grew up in the Midwest didn't really have a lot of that. So I always that's why I said, like, I bet you're the Midwest Catholic and you probably have a great upbringing as well. Now, do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have a brother who's a couple years younger and then a sister that's the youngest by 6 years or so. And my brother, he has this company called Specifically Pacific that they have the federal trademark for the Highway 101, which goes up the whole West Coast. So they do like lifestyle clothing and hats, and it's just
that's
super
awesome.
Cool company. Yeah. So he does that. And then, yeah, my sister, she just moved back to Traverse City and she's a nurse, and her brother, who Freudian slip there, her husband is an ophthalmologist. Uh-huh. He is like a brother to me.
Yeah.
He's super cool.
Maybe that is the weird thing in your family.
That is the weird thing. Shoot. What Game of Thrones going on there.
So what was life like growing up in Traverse City? I mean, I get this impression it's a small city where everyone kind of knew everyone. So you went to high school with your wife, you know, so is it one of these things?
She actually went to a different high school. She was from the public school, and you know, the Catholic school was always those public school kids. Like,
you just sound like an asshole right there.
She went to the public school. She did. And I know that I sounded like an asshole for sure. I think I never fit into like the Catholic school system. So I remember in ninth grade, like everyone was super into football, and it was like a Friday Night Lights kind of school. And like, we'd win the state championship every couple years. And it just like from the youngest age, football was the thing. And I've always been fast, but I've always been skinny. And so not really the football type. And so I really got into Nirvana and the alternative music scene. Yes. And at this Catholic school, I had a chain wallet and they called me Janitor Joe because no one's going to wear chain wallets and be into alternative music. And so I, you know, I had, they had a dress code that said you couldn't have excessively long hair. So I grew my hair long because they didn't define what excessively was. And they're like, you need to cut your hair. And I'm like, as soon as that picture of Jesus comes down that has longer hair than me, then we can talk. And so, wait, I ran
what
for
your parents saying, like, what were your parents, when you, like your dad who grew up in this Catholic tradition?
Oh man. So my dad is like first generation doctoral level psychologist. Like everyone else in his family, like didn't even go to college. So he went from small Midwestern farm town to being a full on psychologist. So he definitely had this like image of what successful families were supposed to be. And long hair and creative fashion was not part of that narrative for him. Whereas my mom had this huge, like, stick it to the man kind of approach where she like really got into like the flowing hippie skirts when she was in her like midlife. She got into like tap dancing, and then she got into like country line dancing, and then went through a phase of like, she'd like cast pennies every morning to see what her future would be. And it was just like too, like, wow. He's so like kind of wants to be the American family. You know, his parents spoke Polish and he didn't. And then like my mom is like, we've been in the United States for generations and I'm sick of just being a WASP. I want to have some like cultural roots. And so there's definitely between the two of them a lot of kind of like back and forth. And I think my mom appreciated the long hair, like kind of alternative, but you know, I wasn't into a lot of the things that went with that in regards to like wrecking my life with, you know, tons of like drugs and things like that. But so
You had the image without the baggage, yeah, essentially.
Everyone at this Catholic school thought that I like, you know, sold drugs, but I ran for student government so that I could like change the policy for the dress code to make it more alternative friendly. And so I was like, yeah, I'll stick it to the man, but I'm going to do it in a way that actually works.
Yeah. Within the framework of the man, but I will stick him once I'm in.
I'm going to stick it to him.
So then where that's awesome. So then where did you go to university?
Yeah, I went to Western Michigan University, went to the Lee Honors College there and did a double major in psychology and comparative religion.
All right. Talking about that. What a.
Yeah. Well, it started with, I wanted a double major just to kind of stand out. And because, you know, when you're in an honors college, everyone wants to like overachieve the overachievers. But then I found out that the comparative religion major was like 5 credits more than all the other minors. And I thought, you know what, like I could double major, but not have to do much more work. And I'm interested in comparative religion. So it worked out on a number of fronts where, I mean, like I had a professor that he was a former Nazi SS guard that was teaching an ethics class.
What?
I know. There's like this other lady who she was
Let's back up on that one real quick. That one to me. How like was it clear to you that he still was racist, or was it one of these things where
he definitely, I don't think he would have been given American citizenship if like he was still like pro Nazi. Like he was definitely like, terrible things can happen when you let terrible people kind of take over the government. And he had watched all of it, but then he also,
have you gone back and talked to him lately?
He was pretty old when I had him, so right. I doubt that he's around anymore, but I would love to hear his thoughts on current political situations. Yeah. But he, you know, he raised questions of like, when there's bad things happening in your community, such as, you know, he saw these foreign invaders coming in, but do the ends justify the means? And like, he just would raise these questions that got you to think about things differently. And I mean, that's the point of an ethics class. And then to have someone that had to live through such a ethical dilemma of, do I join? Do I like stand up against this? Do I like hide people? Do I not? And I mean, at the time he had joined, you know, up with the Nazis.
Well, you kind of have to, I think, then if you did it, they were going to kill you. I don't think your choices were.
Yeah. So he that was one of the more interesting classes. I had another class that was on like Mesoamerican sacrifices. And so we studied like the Aztecs and the Incas and religion in America. And I went to Nepal for a while after that. So it just was a cool exploratory time for me, for sure.
There's a lot of, so I'm, I think you know this, I'm in the Middle East. And so there's a lot of my friends here who go to Nepal all the mm-hmm. time. And there's something about it they can't explain that they just love. I don't know if you had the same feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's for me, it was so just physically challenging. Because like when we got dropped off in Lukla, we were at like 12,000 feet. And then we hiked up to 19,000 some feet. And just the physical side of it is just for anybody, it just takes you on. And then on top of that, just to see mountains that, I mean, like the Rocky Mountains here in the United States, I went to Colorado right after that. And it was like, these are like the foothills of the foothills in Nepal. Like there would be like four times taller. And it's just the majesty of it. And then I think the depth and length of a culture like that, for an American citizen, we just don't have that sort of backstory mm-hmm. here. And that sort of legacy in regards to architecture and tradition. It just really was an amazing place.
So how did that change your perspective on the world?
Well, so it's interesting during that time, I'm getting into tons of stuff I've never talked about on podcasts. I love this. This is cool. So at that time I was super evangelical and I was traveling with a friend of mine that was an atheist and I decided
that's like oil and water. So
I know totally. And so like to make this story even better, I decided it would be smart to smuggle Bibles into Nepal, and not tell him, even though every Bible at that time would be 7 years in prison. So I decided to smuggle these Bibles in, and obviously when my friend Todd found these, he's like, what are you doing? And, so through that process, I think I, up until then, had a very self-centered view of not just spirituality, but just, you know, a young 20 something mm-hmm. and realized, wait a second, like this atheist friend of mine could have ended up in jail for like 80 years. And like, how would those conversations go over 80 years of him being in jail for smuggling Bibles that he doesn't believe in?
I would say there'd be a touch of resentment somewhere in there, at least initially for the first 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that decision really, I think, put a spotlight on like, wow, like I really don't think about other people as much as I think about them. And this was a really self-centered decision to make.
Was that about you or was that about the religion supporting that cause?
I think it was both. I mean, you know, to have friends back home that were like, you're going to smuggle Bibles. Like that's a big boost to the ego, as well as, you know, feeling like it was very much something that I should do. Cause you know, the world needs to have Bibles in that phase of my life. But I think while I was there, to more and more see poverty, to see how people live, to see what people are paid to carry a 100-pound backpack throughout the mountains, that's where I started to feel more of a social justice shift in kind of my own direction in life.
So see, that's what I find fascinating. So I'm not anti-religion. So I don't want to say I'm not an atheist. I don't know what I am. You know, I'm in this exploratory yeah. phase of life. You know, I'm 42. I'm always trying to figure out, like, what the fuck am I doing spiritually? I don't know. But my wife has yeah. this steadfast – I sometimes don't know if it's steadfast, but she has this Catholic belief that I think I've waned her off of 10. Now she's down to about 7 just being married to me. But I think when you travel the world – and Nepal's a great example. But, I mean, I've lived in Australia and Japan and – I've been to Turkey and we're going to Portugal for the summer for 6 weeks. When you travel, it's just my personal belief. When you meet people from all around the world, you realize that no matter what religion, color, creed, we all kind of want the same thing. We all kind of mm-hmm. want to just be kind, generous, helpful people. And I find people who are from much worse off situations are actually usually more kind and more generous. And that really calls into question a lot of things at times, for me at least.
No, I agree. That year when I went to Nepal was also a year that I went to Haiti and
geez, double whammy. Seeing,
yeah. And then actually I volunteered in New Orleans at a shelter for people with AIDS that were in the final stages of AIDS. Like it was a year of like, I want to like discover the world and discover myself. And so it was super transformative. And you know, it started with the Nepal situation and then going to Haiti and New Orleans. And I agree that it's almost like when we suffer, when life doesn't give us everything. And, you know, being raised in the Midwest where, like, just what you said, your life's pretty good if you're just in the Midwest and have a regular family. And then you see all these things that I complained about or I was frustrated about. And then you realize, okay, my toilet water is cleaner than most of the world's water. That's pretty awesome that I have access to clean water, but it's terrible that there's so many preventable diseases that kids die from every day. And I mean, that's just one of many options, many things that you can discover. That it definitely deconstructed the world that I thought was true in this Northern Michigan Catholic Protestant kind of world of affluence. And to be able to then say to myself in my 20s, well, what am I going to do that's going to make a difference in the world beyond just, you know, finish college?
So can you tell me, though, as you're going through this year long, I would say argue it's a spiritual journey to kind of figure out better who Joe is and what the universe kind of means to Joe. How do you, because I've always found this fascinating, you go from smuggling Bibles into Nepal over, I don't know how long, 24 months, 36 months, to kind of unpacking this fundamental Christianity in your mind. How do you struggle with that? Like, how does that unpack?
Yeah. So by the time I got to New Orleans, it was less about passing out Bibles, and every night I would take granola bars and go meet homeless people and just like chat with them. And so it went from me having a message that people need to listen to I need to hear other people's messages. And like just literally sitting down with homeless people, giving them a granola bar and like hearing their stories. And so that was like a 12-month process of probably from smuggling Bibles to being, you know, sitting with homeless people in New Orleans. So then, and it was definitely in phases, but there was a guy, Rob Bell, who's a writer and that was really helpful during that time and was, I think, asking similar questions. And I deconstructed enough that I started to think through, like, what is it that I can believe in now? And so, you know, when you travel, you do see that people, just like you said, often have the very same kind of goals in life. You know, they want to be close to their family and their friends. They want to provide for their kids. And I feel like the more that I studied, the more that I saw that religions were in essence trying to describe in their own culture, in their own time, in their own manner, what they experienced. And it always had their cultural lens. And so if that's, you know, Buddhism or Hinduism, it's going to be through that lens that they have signposts towards kind of the divine or the hum or this energy we feel. You know, for Catholics coming out of, you know, Roman rule, we see a highly structured, it's the exact same structure the Romans had. The Romans had parishes, the Romans had individual districts, they had the same hierarchy we see in the Catholic Church. And so
what I'm asking is how did you struggle with that? Because that's a fundamental shift emotionally inside you of saying, I believed, you know, at one point I firmly believed X. And within 12 months, I now believe more why. And how do you have that conversation with you? Because we're human beings, so we surround ourselves by people who are similar to us. So in doing that, now you've probably gone from hanging out with a lot of evangelicals to what? Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Do you see what I'm trying to get at there?
Yeah. So I think that, and I wouldn't say that the process was complete in 12 months. I mean, this has been since, let's see, I was 23, 24 or so. Right. And that's the thing. I don't think it is. I still have friends that we drink wine and play games and talk theology and sort through these things. And I haven't landed. But what I think I did do is I looked for people that were on a similar journey during that time. And those that kind of had all the answers. Here's what the Bible says. You have to believe it. And it's my version of it. I wasn't drawn to those people. I was drawn to the people that were asking deeper questions. I was drawn to the people that were saying, well, why do we believe this? Maybe we should look and see if there's some other way of viewing this. And so I think what happened was the people that were on a path of, whether you want to call it enlightenment, self-discovery, transformation, those were the people that I found myself just naturally spending more time with because they were engaging conversations that challenged me to think differently about beliefs I had long held.
It was fun. I was just this last week watching the C.K. Louie special on Netflix. And not only he starts off by talking about abortion, so he just jumps right off the deep end right away. But he goes to a segment that was about Christianity. And I'm going to totally bastardize this, but essentially it was Christianity won. He goes, how could you even argue that? They restarted time 2,000 years ago. He goes, so it's like, so if you're 28 at year zero, what are you, zero? Like, how do you, what do you say in year five? Am I five or am I 33? Like they literally zeroed out the clock. So if you ever argue about Christianity not having the most power in the world from a religious standpoint, so anyhow, he goes on this long, it was phenomenal. I never thought about that. And I was like, huh, what an interesting point about Christianity kind of winning the world's religion war by resetting the clock.
Right. And it's so ironic when you think about like the other side of that, that the power, there's the powerful side of Christianity, but then there's other, you know, like even the current Pope, you know, being a Franciscan, like was always on the underside of power and that like helping the poor and those that didn't have power. And to even just focus on, you know, which side of the coin are you looking at? Because there've always been these smaller groups that are doing amazing work, but they're not in the powerful positions often.
So we can talk about religion for a while, but I need to move on to the story a little bit.
Let's do it.
So now the other thing I thought was really interesting was the fact that you ended up being a psychologist like your dad. Now, what I don't know, because I couldn't find this, which tells you either I didn't look very hard or it's just not there, is did you move on to get your PhD?
No. So I have a double master's degree in counseling and in psychology. And so in Michigan, you can practice independently with the master's in counseling. And so that's the main degree that I'm licensed in.
And so did you find yourself kind of trying to follow in your dad's footsteps? And what stopped you from getting your PhD? Was it just not something you desired?
Yeah, you know, for one, I didn't want to follow in my dad's footsteps. He was a school psychologist, and when it was like take your son to work day, I was like, this is the most boring form of psychology in the world. Like, I don't know how you do this every day. So all through grad school, I was doing like experiential approaches to therapy. I started a sailing program to take kids out sailing and do therapy on the sailboat. Like, I was all about high ropes courses and travel and how do we integrate that adventure into counseling. So I knew that was kind of the path that I wanted to go on. But then, you know, I applied for my PhD for one program. Let's see, it would have been probably like 2007. And getting turned down from that program was probably the best thing that could have happened to me. Because at that time, I really thought that to be successful, to be able to make more than $50,000 a year, like you have to get your PhD. Like that's just how it is. And I had such a limited view of the world and what it took to be successful and didn't even think that I could do something other than counseling. Like the idea of doing business consulting and podcasting or like any of that sort of business development, like I'm not trained in business. Why could I do that? So getting turned down was probably the best thing that could have happened for my career.
Isn't it amazing how we put our limits on based on the environment that we spend most of our time in?
Yeah. Well, I think about like both my parents worked for someone else in the school system. Both my in-laws worked for the school system. I did K-12 in a Catholic school that constantly was saying, you know, if you're good enough in eighth grade, then in ninth grade, you'll be better. If you're good enough in 12th grade, you can get into an Ivy League school. If you get an Ivy League school, it was always that the education was what gave you success, not innovative ideas, not creativity, not out of the box thinking. And so that narrative was so strong in my life that even when, you know, I was in my mid-30s, I'm like, I'm going to leave my full-time job. And I'm already making six figures working 10 hours a week. My parents were like, well, you know, there's some security there. And I'm like, wait, let me show you the numbers. But that's their narrative. And that's where they were at. And so, like, I can understand it. But at some point, we have to become our own adults and say, well, I'm deciding that this is my next step.
You know, it's funny because as a, you know, I totally get that. And I, for me, what's always a blocker, what's interesting is the limits I put on my personal self is always based on, for me, the fear of success because I didn't grow up around people who were successful. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what that looks like. And so I often feel like I'm stumbling through life trying to figure out how I can achieve X, whatever that X is. And I don't mean X in a financial way. Sure, that's part of it. But I always find, okay, well, my mom was only a bank manager for 20 years and she was miserable every day. So I don't want to do that. And my dad worked at a desk at a chemical plant for 15 years. And I don't know if he was happy or sad, but he surely wasn't ambitious. So I don't want to do that. But I don't know what ambition looks like. Like, how does that manifest itself? And that's, yeah. And that's where I think I think what you're saying is that you didn't really have a model for you of what that looked like. So how did you seek out someone to give you that framework, or did you just basically build your own house based through experience?
Yeah. So I think that early on, like you think about a typical kind of middle class value of like saving money, like people are going to rip you off. Like I definitely was like, all these consultants just want my money. They aren't going to speed things up. So I bootstrapped so long and would just like listen to podcasts and read books. And then I think over time, I really realized how when people, you know, reinvest in their business, whether that's through consulting or new software, whatever it is, I had to have that kind of switch flip where I got successful, but almost burned out and had to pay people to start taking things off my plate, to realize that, wait, people that are highly successful look for multipliers. They look for a new staff that's going to, you know, more than multiply what they're paying. And that was probably the biggest kind of mental shift I had to make, to realize that, yes, maybe there are consultants that just want to rip you off, but, you know, finding someone that you can trust, that you can bounce things off of, is going to help you do things faster and not spin your wheels.
Did you get a professional coach to help you, or a personal coach?
Yeah. So I have Jamie Masters. She used to be Jamie Tardy from The Eventual Millionaire. She's my coach. She's amazing and has really helped me continue to scale. And it's the best use of money. I was selling tickets to a conference that I'm doing this summer called Slowdown School. And she really helped me figure out how people will buy. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, we sold probably 4 or 5 tickets, so which was almost the cost of all of her consulting for the 6 months we're working together.
Because that's kind of where I'm at right now. So I think to myself, to your point, I'm bootstrapped, so I only have X dollars, and I really enjoy what I'm doing here, like with you. And so how can I use this to move forward, right? And I know that I have my own blocks, and I know a coach would be great, but I can't really afford a coach. But if I invest in myself, would I get that money back? And I kind of keep hearing stories again and again of, just put the money in. Doesn't matter where it comes from. If you do the work, you'll get the money back out on the back end. I have to sell this to my wife, so I'm saying it out loud to you as well. So tell me if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, and I think it is. I don't know if I would agree with what people told you about that you're always going to get your money back. I've heard horror stories from some of my consulting clients where they work with someone and didn't get the money back, and they didn't get clear guidance. So I think it's really important to know what you want. If you just want a coach that's going to make you successful, that I would say that's not probably clear enough. If you want someone that can help you attract your ideal client or get more sponsorships for the podcast or build an e-course, that's where if you can say, okay, I want to build a course that I can sell for $1,000. I want to sell 100 of those a year. And I want to have somebody that's done that, that can work backward to build my email list, use the podcast to do that, you know, have challenges or quizzes that are lead funnels, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That's where I think someone can absolutely help you, but it's more, typically people don't know what they want. And then, you know, good or bad coaches are going to then pitch themselves based on kind of what you say.
Oh, that makes sense. All right. So I need to kind of keep moving on here because there's still some interesting topics about you that I really want to talk about.
Yeah, for sure.
So now how old were you when you finally got married?
25. Wow. Yeah, we were 24. I was 25. She was 24. I thought I was so old when I got married then, but yeah. God, we had snowboarded together in high school and then went our separate ways and got back together.
I would have been a shit hot mess if I got married at 25. There's no way I could have done that. And so, you know, part of your story, which is kind of, I think it adds to the journey that you're on, is some several personal issues you dealt with. You know, the first one was after you had your daughter, she had open heart surgery. Correct?
Yeah. So our oldest was born in 2011. And while I was actually out on one of the boats doing counseling, my wife called like 15 times. And I called her up and she said, we're at the hospital. Lucia has a hole in her heart. We're figuring it out. We're doing x-rays and echocardiograms. Like, get over here as soon as possible.
And how old was your daughter then?
She was like 3 months old at that point. And so then the plan was to do kind of basically plug up that hole in her heart, doing just a catheter type surgery. So they go in there in January-ish. So she's probably 7-8 months or so old at that time. It's supposed to be the last day of this journey. Like, we take her home the next day. Like, that's what the plan is. But the doctor pulls the plug mid kind of surgery and says, you know, we found something else, and she's going to need to have full on open heart surgery. And so we end up going to University of Michigan.
Like, what are your thoughts at that point?
Oh, it was just like disbelief. I mean, it was supposed to be the final page of the book. Like, we move on with our healthy child and we go home and life's all good. Like, we've been like, for those 8 months, she was on a medication that made her go to the bathroom a lot because they didn't want to have fluid build up around her heart. So she would wake up every hour, hour and a half. So that means we had to wake up every hour or hour and a half to change diapers. And so on top of that, she wasn't getting the calories from just breast milk. So we had to do this breast milk with formula mixture for every feeding. And so it had been like, we've sprinted a marathon and we're not runners and we're just exhausted. And then we hear, sorry, like, we've got 3 or 4 months till we're going to get her in for heart surgery. Your sleepless nights are going to continue. Your breast milk milkshakes are going to continue. And you're not done with this yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is gonna sound like a bit of a dick, I guess, but those are all about you. But how are you feeling towards your daughter? Like, I mean, at that point, are you stressed out? Like, is she gonna live? Is she gonna die? Is she, I mean, like, what was the conversation? Because for me, I'm such a, I guess I'm a realist, I say. My wife might, my wife might argue with that a little bit, but I would have gone to worst case scenario straight away in my head.
Yeah. I mean, I think my mom's a nurse practitioner. My sister's a nurse. My wife's an OT, and my mom, brother, aunt, and grandpa have all had open heart surgery. So I think the death side of it was less about, like, is she going to survive? Because heart surgeries had run in the family. It had been successful. We had read all the research in regards to outcomes. So, I mean, no one wants to see your little baby go through that. But, I mean, there was always that worry, but it definitely wasn't the primary worry, because we knew kind of the evidence pushed against it. And so we just kind of keep reminding ourselves of that. And so, yeah. Don't sound like a dick.
No, I didn't mean like that, because, like, it just, in my head, I go to, because I'm not around that stuff. And, you know, I didn't have that family who's had all those experiences. So for me,
yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily know if I would have gone to, like, oh, she's going to die, but I definitely would have been like, all right, well, what's the impact? You know, like, what's the long-term outcome of this going to be? And I definitely would have been like, ah, fuck, my life's going to be miserable again for the next 6 months. Like, you know.
Right. Well, I think part of it too, and part of the backstory also, is that my mom was finishing up a bunch of radiation and chemo for cancer during that time. And so she was, like, potentially going to die. And so for us, we were focused on, and statistically, if one of those was going to go, it was probably going to be my mom at that time.
Way to nerd out with the statistics right there.
I know. When I get back to the corner, I guess I got to go to the stats. Yeah. So then, I mean, but really just then we get her up to weight. She has her heart surgery. We stay at the Ronald McDonald House, at University of Michigan, and, everything went well, and we got the all clear a couple weeks later.
And then obviously the next major battle was yourself at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. So 2 weeks later, right after this, we get the all clear. We're like, all right, we're good to go. I got diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And so we're like back in the medical world again. And we fly down to Texas to meet with a surgeon to get my thyroid removed. I get my thyroid removed. And while I'm doing that, my mom has a heart attack. And my wife then has a miscarriage. A friend of ours gets breast cancer. It was just like one of those years that you're like, holy hell, like, this, like, I wouldn't wish this on anybody.
So what was the stress between you, your wife? Like, I would imagine there would be love, but stress at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, we were so, like, at that time, when we look back on it, it was like, we just had to tread water. And, drank more than I should have been drinking, but, you know, just needed to cope and use that. And mm-hmm. she did too. And we just, it was very like functional, like mm-hmm. what's our next thing? What's our kid need? And then it wasn't till the next summer of 2013 when all of my cancer was fine. My mom was fine. Our daughter was fine. That my wife actually said, like, I think we should separate. And she wanted to go live with her parents. And so I think we hadn't realized just how much of kind of parallel lives we were living. And that was a big wake up call. We got into therapy. We started working on our marriage. We're still together. But that was a super stressful time where we weren't connecting. We, you know, weren't, you know, really connected in a lot of ways.
So what was the biggest thing that you felt like you had to I'm sure there was several, but what was the biggest thing you felt like maybe you guys weren't doing that once you started doing the partnership started to emerge again?
Yeah, I think it's really just feeling that we had to solve every problem or fight every time, and that really we were both so stressed out. It's like sometimes you just got to let things go. It's sort of like if a couple, it's like midnight, you're both tired, you both have had like two or three beers, and then you get in a fight over the dishes, you probably should just go to bed. Like mm-hmm. it was like we would get in those fights over just dumb stuff, and it's like just let it go. Like we don't have to like figure this out right now. We're going through some big things, and so I think that like we just took out our stress on each other.
Cause you know, it's funny, you know, cause how many years you've been married now?
It'll be, let's see, 13 this August.
Okay. So I'll be 10 in June. So I'm a little bit behind you here. But I always find that that one's expectations upon the other one's partner is what sets off the, the domino effect of dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
You know,
we went through, I don't know if you know, Dr. John Gottman, he's a marriage researcher that's been studying marriage for 40 some years, but we went to his Art and Science of Love workshop out in Seattle.
Yeah.
And that was, I wish we had done that in our first year of marriage. I mean, the tools that we learned from that to just like, after you have a fight, here's a walkthrough of how to kind of repair from that and to figure out what happened without being super judgmental towards each other. How do you build connection with each other on an ongoing basis so that if you do get in a fight, it's not as severe? I mean, just stuff that it was just really helpful for us.
I can imagine, like, you know, I grew up in a pretty volatile house. Mary grew up in a family that there just was no arguing. It wasn't an option. So conflict for her was, let's have a conversation, but you never get heated. Conflict for me was mm-hmm. I go to 0 to 10 in 5 seconds. So, you know, I would start to raise my voice. She's like, why are you yelling at me? And then she would shut down. And I'd be like, what the hell? And then so it, for us, it's always like a work in progress, right? Like no marriage is at a stopping point. But I think we've been pretty good because we've, you know, like I'm at my office at 10 o'clock at night almost, right? I've been at work since 8 o'clock this morning. So she's super supportive with what I try to do and I try to support her. And I feel like my thing that I've learned over 10 years, and by no means am I perfect, is that I try to think of her before I think of myself. That doesn't always work. And I sometimes get really pissed off and angry about certain things, but I think that's human nature. But then I'll tell her after I become passive aggressive, like a Catholic. And then I realize I'm being passive aggressive and I say, I'm sorry, I'm being passive aggressive. So this is what's really bothering me. Where Mary, she just lets everything kind of just flow off her. So my craziness doesn't really bother her so much because I do, like, I help do the dishes, I help do the laundry, I sweep the, you know, I help all the time. So I make her life a bit easier when she's running around. So that's for us, I think, has been the number one thing. Now, I will tell you that in 10 years, we have not had one night away from our kids yet because we've not had the support around ourselves. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's been probably been the biggest thing where I'm like, okay, I really would like to get away without our kids for just a night at least. So
sure, yeah. Sure.
So it's what I want to do, and we'll come back to this in a second, but I want to do what's called my fast five. It's supposed to be the halfway point, but it never is. And it's supposed to be fast, but it never is either. So all aboard. So you ready to do fast five?
I'm ready.
All right. So question one, what was your first job ever?
Yeah. So when I was five, I started a lemonade stand and I hired a bunch of the neighbor kids. But then, so that I didn't have to work as hard. but then I realized that the amount coming in and the amount going out was equal and I wasn't making any money. So I shut down the business.
I actually think that's fantastic. You know,
I think I had six kids working for me all on the same shift because we all wanted to hang out and then they all wanted to get paid. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is killing me.
I would have loved to see you put that on your CV at like 20.
Oh yeah, that would have been awesome.
all right, question two. Who do you admire most?
Oh, I don't know if I'd say most, but the person that right now I think that's really helped me is Rob Bell, his writings, his podcast, just the way he explores spirituality and life, and his approach that everything is spiritual has probably made some of the largest impact out of anyone in my life.
Awesome. Question three, always my fave question. What animal best represents your management style?
You know, I was thinking through this. So initially I was going to say a cheetah, because I tend to go really fast and then relax, really fast and relax. But then I thought about how also I have a laid back side. So I think I would say I'm a cheetah that dreams of being a koala bear. So it has an inner koala bear conflict going on.
It's all right, man. I'm cool with a cheetah koala. That's totally fine. Yeah. All right.
A chihuahua.
I couldn't actually say it in my head. I thought of that, but I couldn't actually say it out loud. So I went with the cheetah koala. All right. Question four. What trait most annoys you or irritates you with colleagues that you work with?
I'm working on this, and it's when people can't kind of go at my pace or keep up, which oftentimes is more of a reflection of me than them. But I find that really annoying when it's like, okay, let's go full tilt. And then it's like, well, I think I'm gonna just stroll. And it's like, oh my gosh, come on, people.
Yeah, I usually just kick people out of the car and go by myself, which isn't equally good either. Yeah. So
I know. Yeah.
Question five. When is Joe at his best? What situation brings out the best in Joe?
Yeah, I think when I can create and when I can have something that has like an artistic bend to it, I feel like I'm at my best. Just kind of doing your typical consulting, like that's not my jive, but like out of the box things, coming up with new solutions, that just gets me so excited to think about what could be from what already is.
Awesome. Well, thank you for doing Fast Five.
Yeah.
That was relatively painless. Good job. All right.
Thank you. All right, so I love your affirmations. Yeah.
I gave you three air hugs and a high five. We are good.
No fist bump.
Fist bump.
I'll work harder next time.
It's just that fist bumps aren't intimate enough. I need the hugs. All right.
That's true. Yeah. I'm a hugger. I'm from a hugging family, you know, like a psychologist and a nurse. I was in a professional setting once and I went in for a hug and there was this, and it was a woman and it was like this, like awkward, like, I did not like think this through. And so now it's like, I've kind of like backed off a little bit on the professional hugs.
All right. So for the last 5 minutes or so, I just kind of want to get kind of up to date. So as you start doing this and now we can kind of tell my audience exactly what you do, right? So you are Joe, who owns a consulting firm that helps basically counselors, psychologists, set up practices essentially and do it in a way that's profitable for them in a short take. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I would say that's 90% of the work that I do. I do have some clients that are outside of the counseling field that are just small businesses that want to get bigger. Like I had an online Taekwondo company and I had an environmentally friendly oil and gas company. But so most of my work, I help people to start, grow and scale private practices. And so that could be a counseling private practice, massage therapy, physical therapy. And more times than not, it's that we aren't taught in grad school the basics of business. And so how do you market yourself? How do you find your ideal client? How do you use email marketing and Facebook marketing to grow your practice for 13 cents a click? And then people can continue to grow their practices after we work together.
But don't you find, like I find as a solopreneur, just time. Time is just not on my side to do. So my background, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm a PhD in marketing. And I teach strategy. I teach general marketing. I teach communications. I teach kind of the gambit. So I understand the theoretical stuff and what you're supposed to do, and here's your plan, and here's your execution, and da da da. I find like some of this stuff is so detail specific that, and it takes so much time, that it's really hard for me to find those things to focus on to move the needle a little bit. Is there, when you work with your clients, is there something that if they say that to you, that you can say, all right, well, here's the one thing that I would spend the most time on, at least for the next quarter?
Yeah. So when we do our consulting, at the end of every call, there's a section we have in Trello, which is a project management software we use, that's called, you know, it's going to say James's one thing. And so that's the one thing that you need to do to move the needle forward between our consulting calls. I tend to be less, let's look at the whole quarter. We can look at what the big goals are for the quarter, but really, like, for the next 2 weeks, what should you work on? Because you're right, there's so many things you can work on, but I think that oftentimes we've got to set up kind of the basics. And so, do you have your email flow? Do you have an automated sequence? Is that, are people getting tagged within that? So that whether it's a private practice or you're a podcaster or whatever your thing is, that you can then make decisions based on what people do instead of just a hunch. So what often happens is people will create an e-course or a book, or they'll launch something in their counseling practice, and they don't really know if their audience is even going to care. And so then they spend all this time trying to sell some e-course or sell whatever it is they're trying to sell, but it's not something that their audience has even asked for, or they don't even know what their audience wants. And so reverse engineering it and saying, well, let's build an audience and then let's survey them as to what they want. That's going to make it a lot easier to sell whatever it is that you're selling.
That's a really good point. Yeah, there's a saying that I try to tell students is the customer will always tell you what you're worth. And so that's essentially what you're saying is, like, you could create all you want, but if the customer doesn't want it, they're going to tell you it's not worth anything. And they're not going to pay for it at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you made this transition, because you still do a little bit of counseling, correct?
Yeah, probably 3 to 5 sessions a week.
Do you miss that at all? Or do you get just enough of that to kind of, because you obviously have compassion in you as well to do that type of thing. So do you miss doing that at a larger sum?
Not really. I think that
I love it.
After going to the Art and Science of Love workshop, I went through the Gottman Institute's training to help couples. That was really the first time that I felt really excited about counseling again. So helping couples to connect again has definitely been an area that I'm excited about. But we do all sorts of things that go beyond just making more money with Practice of the Practice. I mean, to see people that go from, I help 2 people that are dealing with an eating disorder, to having a full practice with 3 extra clinicians. Now we're helping 100 people a month. Like, for me, we're genuinely changing the entire shape of the private practice world. And so that world changer side, like, hasn't gone away just because I can make more money at it. To me, it's still like, what are we going to create that's going to genuinely shape and change the world? And so, like, lately I've been promoting this World Changers Challenge, where we're doing this 7-day challenge to go after a big idea, plan it out and structure and take those first steps towards it. So we've got all these counselors and private practice owners that for a week in June of 2017, we're all getting together. I'm going to be doing live Facebooks in a private group, and it's totally free, just to help them launch these big ideas. So I feel like it's more of an impact than just kind of one-off counseling, like one person at a time, to be able to say to this huge community of people, hey, like, let's genuinely change the world. Let's launch your e-course and teach people how to reduce their depression. That's amazing to be a part of something so big.
So, you know, I was thinking as you were saying that, and I was just kind of curious your thoughts on this. You know, your profile is growing quite rapidly across the U.S. for what you do. Why do you think that is? Like, what are you doing different? Because I'm sure other people have tried to do this over the last 75 years. So why do you think what you're doing is it what or how you're doing it is resonating with the general audience?
I don't think it's what, because there's a lot of consultants out there that are saying things that are similar, and they aren't getting much of a following. I would say it's probably more how. With the podcast, I really try to just be super honest about what I struggle with, where I'm stuck. I try to create practical resources for people. And I do think that I've really tried to reinvest in the business to have multiple virtual assistants that are helping me scale things quicker than just a typical solopreneur. So I'm bringing on in June, I'm bringing a lady on full time to do all of my design. She's been doing it probably 20 hours a month, and she's going to be 35 hours a week starting June 1st. And I have a lady that kind of goes through my emails and responds to people. And then if she like doesn't know how to respond or something I have to do, then she stars it. So I can be super efficient and do the things that only I can do and have other people do the things that have to get done, but that I just shouldn't be doing. So I think that scaling side of it, people don't often reinvest in, hey, maybe I should hire someone for $15 an hour to do these things that I'm spending time on. Even if I enjoy them, I probably shouldn't be doing those because it's not going to help me scale this business. Because what I notice is that when what gets people to 100,000, for example, is usually a lot of hustle, a lot of bootstrapping, a lot of like cost savings. But then the exact opposite is what gets people to $500,000. They have to take everything off their plate, pay as much as they can out to other people to scale it, to go beyond just them.
Because that frees you up to be the face, not behind a desk at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I can show up and do a Facebook Live and people can be like, how are you doing all this? And it's like, because I have four other people that are working behind the scenes or automated systems like Meet Edgar or auto sequences or quizzes that all run without me touching them. So then I can just do a Facebook Live, talk about things. I can connect with people. I can get interviewed on podcasts or interview people on podcasts. Those are things I'm not going to send somebody in my place to come on your podcast as Joe Sanok. So
you know, that would have been awesome, though, if you tried to do that, by the way.
Actually, the big reveal here is I'm actually Joe's virtual assistant.
Tommy.
My name's Tommy.
Yeah. All right. So I've had you on long enough. I have one final question, Joe. I could talk to you for probably hours. We had some great conversations. But here's what I really want to know. This is it. This is the crux. This is the finale.
All right.
All right. I'm building this up. This is no Everest. I just want you to be aware of that. And I'm not a Sherpa. Either way. So how do you define happiness for who you are and where you're at in your life?
How do I define happiness for where I'm at right now? I define it in a couple different areas. I want to feel like I'm genuinely impacting the world in a positive way. And so that's less of a kind of key performance indicator, like it means like this much money or this many followers, but it's more of, do I feel like I'm talking to people and their lives are being changed because of the work that I'm doing? Mixed with that is continuing to have strong boundaries around my lifestyle. And so I only work 3 days a week. I take Mondays and Fridays off. I hang out with my wife and my daughters on those days. And so being able to have time to go stand up paddleboarding, to, you know, make forts with my 2-year-old and 5-year-old, that's the other side of it for happiness for me. And that satisfaction, I think, comes from those deeper connections with both my family and then my friends.
That is awesome. Well, Joe Sanok of Practice of the Practice. So thank you for your time, your energy, and your willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Thanks.